Thank you, Friday guys, for that railing over there that I forgot to use. I'd like to tell you a second story. It's based very loosely on the tale of Old Turtle and the Broken Truth by Douglas Wood. Long ago in a far-off land, the stones held wisdom. The breezes whispered their teachings. The waters reflected beauty. And the trees pointed the way to the great mysteries. And that was all the people needed. But into this far and lovely land there fell a truth. It streaked down from the stars, trailing a tail as long as the sky. But as it fell, it broke into many pieces. Pieces of the truth landed all across the lovely land. Some fell in the north, some in the west, some in the south, and some in the east. And as the pieces of truth were discovered by the people of Earth, they admired its shininess. They learned all they could about their piece of the truth, and they honored it, and they cherished it, and they worshipped it. They thought, how lucky we are to be able to own this great, shiny truth. Surely we are more blessed than all the other people on Earth, because we have been chosen to hold the truth. But, as you can imagine, this led to squabbles between the peoples of the land because the holders of each piece of truth believed that their truth was the one true truth. More all-knowing, more all-powerful than anyone else's truth, and walls were built to safeguard each unique truth. Wars were fought between the holders of different pieces. And each enclave of humanity came to fiercely believe that they were the chosen people of the great truth, and all others were lesser. It was a young girl who, weary of anger and fighting and grieving the losses that came from warring humanity, began a young people's movement to gather all the youth from all the warring nations into a council of peace. To listen to each other, to really examine each other's truth and begin to explore together a path to peace. And that great council, when all the pieces of truth were brought together, they made a wondrous discovery. All the shiny pieces of truth fit together into one perfect whole, more beautiful than any of the parts alone. And so the people went their own ways once more with their shiny piece of truth, but they never again forgot that it was only a part of the greater truth, and that together they were part of the one, and to hurt their neighbors was to hurt themselves. In our UU principles, we affirm to promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person. But I think it would be a safe bet to say that you're all thinking of at least one person that this is a value difficult to honor with. When I stayed at the Siddha Yoga Ashram, there are signs above the doors reminding us that God dwells within you as you. Many spiritual traditions ask that we see God in everyone. Within our own church community, that's not too difficult. We have to work a bit harder when we expand our sight to encompass every person, even people who don't recycle. A Southern Baptist sitting next to a UU on a plane said, I heard that Unitarians deny the divinity of Jesus. No, replied the UU, we don't deny the divinity of anyone. C. Seeing God in everyone brings us full circle in our principles to respect for the interdependent web of life. If all beings are connected, then of course each being is precious. Each person's unique gifts are precisely what is needed to complete a grand cosmic tapestry. We cannot see the whole elephant. We cannot see the whole design or the whole truth. But the colors that we individually contribute are essential to the beauty of the whole. And so are theirs. We also covenant to affirm and promote the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process. We certainly don't all think alike or agree on everything, even right here in this church community. But we are called on to trust the democratic process. In the words of the early UU reformist minister and transcendentalist Theodore Parker, democracy means not I am as good as you are, but you are as good as I am. My connection with the sacred is only as precious as my willingness to acknowledge the same connection in others. We may disagree, but we strive to listen, to be open to forgiveness, to assume good intentions, and to use the democratic process to navigate our community through the changes that may come. Barack Obama, speaking at Grant Park in Chicago in November of 2008, on the evening he was elected president, chose to quote from Lincoln's first inaugural address, "The mystic cords of memory stretching from every battlefield and patriot grave to every heart and hearthstone all over this broad land will yet swell the chorus of the Union when again touched, as surely they will be, by the better angels of our nature." In these challenging times when many fear for our country's very democracy, these words still inspire, but are inspiring words enough? Lincoln's words did not stave off a disastrous civil war, and Obama's eloquence could not unite a deeply divided country. So what can we do about the widening gulf between us and them? As often happens, when you put a question out to the universe, like, what can we do to bridge the chasm between all the good, caring people like us and those other people? An answer appears. I thought there must be someone who can teach us how to talk to people with whom we disagree and still view each other as humans and not forked-tailed demons. And it turned out that there was. The Better Angels organization offers skills workshops for red-blue depolarizing and for depolarizing within and uncovering our own biases and stereotypes. And they offer training for moderators. So looking for a workshop in New Hampshire and finding that there were none and there were no trained moderators in New Hampshire, I became one. Well, seemed like someone should. So, Better Angels teaches skills that will allow us to see the other as a fellow human that we can work with on common causes, even though we still deeply disagree. After our delicious potluck lunch, I'll be sharing that skills training here with you in Emerson Hall. You're welcome, even if you didn't sign up for your free tickets on Eventbrite. The pre-registration was just so we could get an idea of how many cookies we needed for the break. Yes, there will be cookies. So I look forward to seeing you there.
Thank you, Linda, for doing such a nice job of grounding us in our principles, our values, what we strive for, and for this amazing opportunity to actually be able to do something, to engage in the process of learning how to move towards the world that we seek. I think my job this morning feels a little bit like trying to go a little deeper with some of the nuance about maybe why we're so polarized. And this was really hard work for me. I think it's very difficult because it's complicated. It has a lot to do with the history of our country going all the way back to its founding and what and its founding principles and who was included and who was not. And I'm not going to really go into a lot of that, but I really encourage you to learn more about American history, especially American political history and the power dynamics of American political history, because polarization is sort of the horse of a different color. It's the same horse, it's just wearing a different color. It's a smokescreen that's being used to divide people who have been oppressed or people who don't have power from one another to keep them from gaining power. And if you think that things are getting worse a lot, you're not alone. And exit polls from the midterms in 2018, 76% of voters believe that our country is becoming more divided. And a new Pew study shows that 60% of Americans believe that both parties have become too extreme, and that 87% of Americans say political polarization is, this is strong language, threatening our way of life. Think about that. What do you think that means? Threatening our way of life. And what do these extreme poles between red and blue, what does that really mean? And I know that some of you, and I am included in that, are living with this great divide between red and blue in your own families, and it can be so painful. It can be so painful. And part of the reason is that because partisanship has become very, very personal, right? It's not just about policy, because you know as soon as you start talking about policy with somebody you disagree with, it goes to ideology, what they believe. But even below the ideology, there's something even more central, which is our very identity, our sense of belonging, and what gives us a sense of self-worth. Sociologist Arlie Russell Hochschild calls this deeper sense of who we are, who we trust, and where we feel we belong, our deep story. Our deep story, the story that feels as if it's true. Not the true story, but the story that feels as if it's true. And that's a really important distinction. In her book, Stranger in a Strange Land, she writes, "Trust and betrayal are feelings that are rarely discussed in the public arena. I think we'd all be better served to try to understand the deeper story there. The deeper story is driven by feelings, particularly the fear of losing one's place, one's identity." Trust, betrayal, fear of losing one's place, one's identity, these are feelings that are highly charged. And you know that from personal experience. Even if you haven't experienced in your daily life, you've certainly seen it in the media and in the way the news is presented. They're tightly held. You can't really change somebody's feelings about how they see themselves in the world very easily. And more often than not, they operate at a subconscious level. Sometimes we're not even aware of them. They can be easily triggered, and they are not subject to logic or persuasion for any of us. What starts out as a conversation about healthcare policy can quickly wind up feeling very personal, like a very personal attack, like one's way of life is being threatened. In his book, Why We're Polarized, journalist Ezra Klein says that partisan politics have become the mega narrative. They're the big story in our identities, more neatly now than ever. Fall along party lines. To paraphrase, he says, politics aren't just about material interests or ideology. They're primarily about identity. which group or groups we belong to, which party listens to us and takes us seriously, which party represents us and wants to elevate our status. There's been this kind of sorting process that divides people based on their identities, rural versus urban, Christian versus other versus non-affiliated with any organized religion, white versus people of color, which impacts where we shop, where we get our news, even the kind of music that we listen to. It all falls into these silos of red and blue. At least that's our perception, right? And what happens, he says, is that something that challenges one of these identity markers begins to inflame them all and create these much bigger senses of threat from the other side, which seems more and more different from you. More and more different from you. And so when you attack a person's political affiliation, you're attacking their deeper story, their feelings about their experience, their worldview, their story about themselves and their lives, the feelings about what they hold as true. It goes deep. It goes deep. Resonates for me. I don't know if it resonates for you in your experience, but it certainly does for me. To the heart of who we feel we are. And it's no wonder then that trying to bridge the political divide feels so emotionally charged, because it is. It's not about policy. Well, it is, right? Sure it is. But it's just as much about these identity markers that get people really fired up. The political has become personal. And we need to develop a much more nuanced way of thinking about the intersection between identity and politics in this country. But make no mistake about it, polarization is the ultimate divide and conquer strategy. Humans have a tendency to put each other in boxes anyway, but a powerful minority is using that tendency to keep the majority fearful and angry, pitted against each other, rather than doing an analysis of the power dynamics where a few win at the expense of many, many, many others. The consolidation of wealth and power in this country right now is unprecedented, and the rest of us are just squabbling at each other. Who really has the power? Which is a very different question from what's at stake for those with power afraid of losing it. And yet, who has the microphone? Right? Again, I encourage you to learn more about U.S. history, especially the way our political system is set up, to begin to understand that those power dynamics are built really right into the way that our government is set up. Just a very small example of that is that every state gets 2 senators, right? Regardless of who lives there or how many people there are in your state. So there's unequal representation in some states over others. It's just one small example. The one thing that I want to lift up that Ezra Klein has to say about power dynamics is that there actually is a reasonably stable white Protestant Christian power structure in this country that has had a lot of control since the very beginning of our country. Something that drives me mad, he says, about the identity politics debate is that we do not have more identity politics in America today. We actually have less. What happened is that we used to have such a powerful form of identity politics coming from this hegemonic majority that nobody called it identity politics because it was just what it was. It was just politics. It was the norm. It was the norm, and as more and more diverse people started to speak from their personal perspective, we all of a sudden have this thing called identity politics, which is not the norm, right? So, and I could go on and on about that, but I'm not going to this morning. I want to get back to where Linda started and what she brought us to, is what are we supposed to do with all of this in the face of all this divisiveness? And I, too, believe that we are called to reground ourselves in our principles, our values. And I picked the first two. Affirming the worth and dignity of all people and justice, equity, and compassion in our relationships. Our own deep story is so important when we think about the worth and dignity of all people. Because we're all grounded in our own story, what we feel is true. And that has an incredible impact on the way that we see others. It's like only being able to feel the elephant's tail. It's what we know. It's very hard for us to know and understand the experience of the whole elephant or the whole truth when we're so grounded in our own deep story. So becoming really conscious of our own deep story is really important. And I know how I felt the day after the 2016 election. I felt many of the things that Richard Blanco expresses in the poem that I shared with you during the meditation. It had been a long time, and I thought this country had come a long way since I'd felt so overtly outcast as a lesbian in this country. I felt like I didn't belong, and I didn't feel safe. And I know that experience and my experience on an almost daily basis with people who support the present administration since then makes me want to put up walls to protect myself. I believe there is a real and present danger based on how I identify in this country. So how am I supposed to transcend that? How am I supposed to bridge that divide and really take my own wall down so I can listen deeply and really try to understand the deep story of another person very different than myself? Fear keeps me from being curious enough, brave enough, perhaps, sometimes to try to find out more about the whole elephant. So this work that we're engaging in, that we're beginning today with Linda, is very courageous work. Very courageous work to become conscious of your own deep story and how it impacts the way that you see others. What is it that makes it hard for you to reach across the divide? How does your story serve you? Including, how does it help you maintain the privilege that you might have? And then what's more, maybe even, is how does it serve the common good? When we go back to our principles and our values, there are a lot of things there. That's our story too. Those firmly held beliefs that are part of our identity, part of our deep story. How does that deep story serve justice? How does it serve equity? How does it serve compassion? And I want to circle quickly back to last week's message. Can we truly sing, "I love everybody"? I love everybody. I love everybody in my heart and truly mean it. And can we ground that love in the kind of self-determination that says, I'm not going to let you tell me who I'm going to love and who I'm not going to love. I'm not going to let the hater make me hate. This was such an important message brought forward from those who really struggled within that context, those black folks that struggled within that context of oppression during the civil rights movement. If they can do it, by God, so can we. I believe that. Then there's the power analysis. I believe we're called to cut through the smoke and mirrors to expose those in power. for what they are. We can't let people in power use our differences to divide us. We will not be manipulated into maintaining systems that maintain injustice. I want to thank Candy for sharing a blog with me this week, a blog post from an evangelical minister, the Reverend Rob Shank. And the title of this is a bit provocative, and I really mean for it to be more general than this, but the title is Why I Will Not Vote for Donald Trump. And believe me, it's the first time I've ever said the name of a political anybody in the pulpit ever before. But I was so taken with this that I just have to share it with you. It's about what we stand for rather than what we stand against. And that's what he really got around to. And what he says, and I quote, "The deal between many Christians and the president has proved to be a deal with the devil. The president has corroded public discourse, presented a terrible role model when it comes to how we should treat others, fostered fear, anger, resentment, and contempt, and exploited the most vulnerable among us for his own aggrandizement. None of this reflects the virtues enumerated by Christ in his Sermon on the Mount, nor the fruits of the Spirit enumerated by the Apostle Paul." This fellow is brave. This evangelical minister is not making any friends. And while I am sure that I could still find some things to disagree with Reverend Shank about, in his interpretation of the Bible and the policies that might come forward from his views about his beliefs, there is much that we have in common. And this is a wonderful example of how we bridge the divide. To think that I have something in common with an evangelical Christian minister is really quite novel, right? And yet I grew up in the Methodist Church, and I do carry some of those things with me. I believe God is love, and I believe that God calls us to service. And I believe that we are called to treat those who are less fortunate than ourselves as ourselves. I believe we're called to love. And I have to agree, and it wouldn't matter what party or affiliation, if there was anybody out there doing all these kinds of things that Reverend Shank is talking about, I would have to agree with him that this is something that I would not want to have carried on in my name because it does not represent my values or in the name of something that I believe in. And I do believe there's too much anger. And that anger probably stems in a lot of cases from fear. Unnamed fear. Subconscious fear, perhaps. But fear that gets whipped up to a frenzy and fed with this vitriol of hatred. It's not Christian. It's not you. It doesn't reflect anything that I would venture to say 90%, maybe more, I don't know, 95% of Americans would affirm, really, as human beings, one to another. And so for me, depolarization begins with affirming the dignity of every worth and dignity of every person, especially the most vulnerable among us. A value that is part of our Christian heritage, part of our UU heritage, and yes, something that we have in common with this evangelical Christian. And I hope that we can begin together to unpack the layers of our identities on both sides, to find ways to transcend these boxes of red and blue that we've put one another in. And yes, I think it will require humility, and it will require courage. It will require deep listening and the desire to see each other in the fullness of our humanity. May it be so. It's our custom in this congregation to share our offering